Wimbledon kicks off today, the pinnacle of tennis. The sport reaches far beyond the manicured courts of England to places like war-torn Sierra Leone.
If it wasn't for tennis, I could have been a child soldier. I could have been dead.
Today on The World, how sports transform our lives and get us stoked for competition and camaraderie. We'll meet boxers in Cuba, jump rope in China, and talk to the nutritionists who help elite athletes fuel up.
I have a lot of athletes maybe messaging me, I'm sick, it was the food, which normally isn't the food, it's just nerves or whatever.
Plus, we hear how American football is gaining popularity in Spain with schoolgirls among the peewee players.
Y me gusta mucho porque me divierten los entrenos.
Practice is fun, she says. We're going to have fun today. It's a full hour of sports on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is an all-sports edition of The World. Sports have the power to unite us, to test our physical limits.
The shot of the tournament, it defied physics.
And tap into something essential in the human desire to excel.
Too many people to thank. It's just been incredible. My God.
It's competition, of course, but sports are also politics, money, and culture. Today on The World, an hour of some of our favorite stories from the world of sports in all its facets around the globe. Seeing as Wimbledon kicks off today just outside London, why don't we start the show with tennis? Last fall, the U.S. Open in New York was a showcase for at least one rising star in tennis, Francis Tiafoe. Tiafoe was born in Maryland to parents from Sierra Leone. His success energized tennis fans around the world, especially in West Africa. Sam Jallo is a friend of Tiafoe's family.
You know, I was so excited and so wanted him to win because, like I said, this would change tennis for good, you know.
Sam Jallo himself is a former pro tennis player, also from Sierra Leone. He credits the game with saving him from the country's civil war in the 1990s. Jallo tells his story in the book, Play Tennis, Not War, How Tennis Saved My Life. Here's part of our conversation from last fall as he watched his friend, Francis Tiafoe, at the U.S. Open.
If it wasn't for tennis, I could have been a child soldier. I could have been dead because so many things happened to me, which I wrote in my autobiography of how the soldiers came in and then we got captured because we were all very young. They thought we were rebels. But what helped me so greatly to stay focused and away from becoming a child soldier was the fact that I have tennis. And I wanted to play tennis for my country to represent Sierra Leone. And I wanted to help, you know, to feed my mom and dad and to get out of this situation. So one of the soldiers who came from Nigeria was a foreign soldier. And he actually helped me out because at one point I got captured. And that was a week before I actually traveled for my first ITF tournament. And thankfully, one of the soldiers who were sent to capture us because we were children who looked like we're up to no good, as the commander said, and this guy actually knew me, and I know him because I was playing tennis with him as a soldier when he came and we become friends. So he was the guy who took me aside and said, look, Sam, you have to escape because this situation is very bad, and I never want to see you again. And that's why my title is How Tennis Saved My Life, because if it wasn't for tennis, you know, I could have been dead or been a child soldier.
Yeah, what a story. Moving up to today, when you watch Tiafoe's game, what does it take you back to when you recall your early playing days? What resonates and what do you feel has changed overall?
See how the game, obviously tennis, the physicality side has changed, the technology behind rackets and string has changed, but also the athlete speed and some of the balls that Francis was retrieving yesterday and was absolutely amazing. But to see that, it just, you know, kind of myself, when I was a kid, I was very aggressive. And I wanted to play tennis so badly, you know, like I said, to help and feed my family. But tennis in the last 20 years has changed completely, like I said, again, with the physicality. You look at Tiafoe, how physically fit he is. So it's a really good inspirational story. And like I said, tennis is different today compared to, you know, when I was competing. So I'm so happy, I'm so excited. And his tennis is so lovely to watch.
Of course, tennis in West Africa, in Africa generally, is a game that is very much a function of colonial rule, both France and Great Britain. Does it still have that association? Does that mean anything for younger players?
Tennis is still there. It's been there forever. And in my club where I grew up, it was built in 1904 by the British colonial people. But people are now taking the sport. Younger children want to play. They're seeing the likes of Serena. They're seeing the likes of Venus. And then also Coco Gauff. And now Francis Tiafoe is making an impact. It's still a very big challenge because, like I said, associations are struggling financially and also to get the right people in the association. But the kids themselves are actually so determined to play. I was in 10 countries I did 10,000 miles on the road. I went to Sierra Leone. I did a lot of kids program and then finished to Liberia, Ghana, and then I end up in Nigeria. And the passion and the enthusiasm from the children is so profound that if we just have the organization, we will start seeing so many champions, you know, coming from West Africa and Africa in general.
Sam Jallo, former tennis pro from Sierra Leone and today a tennis coach. Sam, great to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Football, and I'm not talking soccer now, but football, American football, it's growing in popularity internationally, in case you hadn't heard. In fact, the NFL has been scheduling regular season games in Mexico and Europe since 2005. In Spain, the game is catching on with women and girls who want to play, as Jerry Haddon reports from L'Hospitalet in Spain's northeast.
Here's a championship game you probably missed this fall. It kicks off with football players setting up their own goalposts. Normally, this is a soccer field. With the posts in place, the game begins. The Drax, or Dragons of Badalona, are squaring off against the pioneers of L'Hospitalet, vying for the Catalonia Cup. There are only about 200 spectators here on this sunny Saturday, mostly players' families. Among them, Pilar Palomeque. Her kid plays American football in Madrid, but she says she and her husband catch games wherever they can. She says she loves this game because opposing fans don't yell at each other like they do during soccer games. The Drax are heavily favored today. Of the 8 teams in this pay-to-play club league, they're, well, sort of like the Patriots under Tom Brady, winning titles year after year. Players and coaches say it's because they train hard. This without salaries or sponsors and feeling forever marginalized. 2 weeks before the Cup, on a Sunday night at 10 p.m., the Drax are just starting practice. It's the only time slot they can get. Still, though, the players take it in stride.
Yo creo que el fútbol soccer es para gente mediocre.
On a water break, one 14-year-old, Zion Soleil, says that soccer is for mediocre athletes. We American football players, he says, are special. Not everyone can make the cut. Practicing tonight are the A-League adults, a junior team, the Peewees playing flag football, and an all-women squad. Zion's little sister, Newt, plays. She's a quarterback.
Y me gusta mucho porque me divierten los entrenos.
I like football because the practices are fun, she says. Her longest pass in a game, she says, 30 yards. She's 10 years old. Football in Spain is really inclusive. That appeals to 22-year-old fullback Edu Molina.
Sobre todo el compañerismo y el espíritu de familia.
I play for the camaraderie and the feeling of family, he says. I got turned off by soccer, he says. I couldn't deal with all the fake injuries. I wanted real contact. Contact on the field, with fans, and now, possibly, with the NFL itself. The league wants more diehard followers like these. This season, the Vikings have played in London, the Buccaneers in Munich. And teams are adopting countries through a new program meant to grow the fan base. On a recent night at the Hard Rock Cafe in downtown Barcelona, Chicago's playing Miami on the big screen. The Bears and Dolphins have sistered up with Spain, which, by the way, has the 8th largest number of NFL fans in the world, according to a recent study. The place is packed. 22-year-old IT worker Antonio Treire is here wearing a Chiefs jersey. He says he became a football fan after a friend in the U.S. explained the rules. He says he loves the game's complexity. The fact that you need 55 players to form a team, he says, and that each position has a specific function. Unlike in other sports, he says, where players do a bit of everything. Both NFL clubs have flown over some vets for this event. The Bears' Sean Gale is working the room and posing for photos. Gale was a defensive back for Chicago. He has his own Super Bowl ring from 1985. He was also one of the original Super Bowl Shuffle crew, even if most of these younger fans don't remember that rap victory video. It was, after all, before the internet. Gale says today the NFL's online presence can catapult the league anywhere.
For the longest, the NFL had to function within the borders of the U.S. That's changed now. Soccer's king, but I gotta believe the NFL will appeal to so many people that someday that we'll have a real stake in Europe.
That could mean more games here, or even a permanent franchise, say, in Madrid. The possibilities get Spain's diehard fans and players even more amped up. Back at this year's Catalunya Cup, the Dracs take the title. Players dance on the 50-yard line, fans storm onto the field by, well, the dozens. With a bit more NFL love, goes the league's thinking, the number of spectators could swell for these local games and for NFL matches. And who knows, one day the Dracs might just get their own dedicated field with permanent goalposts. No soccer allowed. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in L'Hospitalet, Spain.
Granted, contact sports may not be your cup of tea, either as an athlete or as a spectator. Just getting outside, though, that is for everyone, regardless of age or skill level or even mobility. That's the belief of a cycling group in Denmark. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on a program that helps us all feel the joy of being on a bike.
Copenhagen is known for its bike-friendly streets. Olli Kaso worked for years to make it that way.
So, you know, I was very aware of all the different types of population groups in the city and the cityscape and the streets and so on.
But Kaso saw that older Danes were largely left behind in the plans. So he got to work again.
What is it we do with our cities that can promote access by elders?
He found his answer by starting Cycling Without Age, a global organization that takes people with limited mobility out for free bike rides on a trishaw. It's like a rickshaw, but the passengers sit in front of the person pedaling. To date, more than 5 million people have taken rides like these. There are chapters in 52 countries around the world, including Scotland, where Eileen McCauley volunteers to pedal people around.
We don't go any faster than walking pace, so everything is, you know, kind of within reach.
Each ride can last anywhere from 20 minutes to an entire afternoon. McCauley says she sometimes stops with her passengers for tea or an ice cream cone.
So it doesn't seem to be something that, you know, you've done it a couple of times. Okay, right, well, we've done that. It seems to build on because every ride has something different happening.
McCauley's favorite person to take for a ride is her mom, Mary McKell. At nearly 102 years old, McKell says she loves going out with her daughter.
You get out into the fresh air and you meet lots of new friends.
She says it reminds her of when she was a little kid, learning to ride a bike at her grandmother's house in the country.
Back in those days, there was very few motor cars on the road.
All these years later, Mikkel says getting to feel the wind in her hair is something she really looks forward to. In fact,
it's fun to be dozy.
Volunteer Adam Binney thinks so too. He's just 20 years old and says the generational gap is no issue.
I really enjoy the aspect of hearing people who have seen so much more life than I have. These people can remember going back to World War II, so it's a great way to meet new friends of all ages.
These cherished relationships were abruptly cut off at the beginning of the pandemic. But before long, founder Olli Kaso says his volunteers across the globe found unique ways to keep busy.
People were using the bikes to go shopping for elders. In Portugal, they would basically take social workers and psychologists out in these bikes so that they could sit and talk to elders out of the window or on balconies.
Ridership is now back at 100% of pre-pandemic levels in most countries, Kaso says, with people of all ages signing up to go for a spin every day. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
We'll hear more reporting from Bianca later this hour. The specialized stadiums and arenas that house our favorite sports are also sometimes an environmental blight. Coming up, what happens to massive sports complexes after the big game leaves town? It's all sports, all the time, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The Men's World Cup of Soccer in Qatar was one of the most controversial stories from the world of soccer, in a sport that is not short on controversy. Abuses of human rights topped the list of criticisms leveled at FIFA and Qatar. Qatar built, with migrant labor, a lot of really snazzy stadiums exclusively for the competition. And once the games were over, then what happens to all the buildings and the problems inherent in their construction? The world's Shirin Jafari looked into that as the party was ending in Qatar last December.
The final cheers rang out at Lusail Stadium in Qatar.
Football World Cup, or the Soccer World Cup, like you call it in the US, are events that provide immense joy.
But that joy comes with something else, says Julian Gersotti with Greenpeace in the Middle East.
That's what makes this particular World Cup, you know, leaves you with a sour taste in your mouth. Because it's something that is providing a lot of joy is also being stained by, you know, these big environmental impacts that the World Cup is creating and it's going to leave behind.
The Lusail Stadium hosted 10 games. And just like the other stadiums and venues for this World Cup, it was built by migrant workers, mostly from South Asia. Qatar has received a lot of criticism for its labor practices. The exact number of workers who died or were injured while building these venues is not clear. Its claims about sustainability have also come under fire. Lusail, for example, was designed with a cooling system.
We are not cooling the whole stadium. We are only cooling small layer.
Saud Abdul Ghani is an engineering professor at Qatar University. He specializes in air conditioning, which earned him the nickname Mr. Cool. Ghani was responsible for the air conditioning at Lusail. He says he kept sustainability in mind. For example, the energy for the cooling system comes from solar panels.
In Europe, Germany or UK, we have anti-frosting system to heat the field of play. You know, it's more or less the same. I mean, we use energy, but the trick is to use it sustainably, to use it with a responsibility.
Qatar claimed that this World Cup will be fully carbon neutral. It promised to offset its carbon emissions by buying carbon credits. But many, like Julian Gersotti of Greenpeace, are skeptical.
Yeah, this World Cup will have and is having tremendous impact on the environment and specifically on climate.
Besides the stadiums, Qatar built new roads, a new airport, a metro system, and about 100 new hotels. Many of the visiting fans traveled to and from Qatar by air. Some stayed in nearby cities like Dubai and Abu Dhabi, flying in and out for the games.
That World Cup is supposed to emit a total of 3.6 million tons of CO2. And to put things into perspective, that's 70% higher than the previous World Cup that was held in Russia.
In an attempt to cut down the number of stadiums they are left with, the Qataris decided to make one temporary. Stadium 974 was made by stacking shipping containers on top of one another. 974 of them, all were disassembled after the games. Qatar says it has plans for the other stadiums. One of them, called Al Bayt, is going to be turned into a boutique hotel and sporting venue. But Khaled Diab says that's not exactly environmentally friendly. Diab is with an organization called Carbon Market Watch. It published a report criticizing Qatar's carbon neutrality claim.
The most sustainable kind of stadium is a stadium that isn't built in the first place, you know.
Qatar has a small population, he says, and it's unlikely it will need that many hotels, stadiums, parks, and athletic centers. In the past, hosting countries have ended up with infrastructure that was left to crumble after the events. This is so common, they even have a name. They're called white elephants. Diab says we need to do better.
You could designate somewhere in the world as neutral sporting territory, set up a permanent venue there for all sort of international sporting events.
Hold games regionally, that way teams and fans don't need to fly in and out. Encourage fans to travel by land. Reduce the number of teams that can qualify and the number of seats in the stadiums, he says. But these won't happen until FIFA and the host countries commit more seriously to reducing their carbon footprint, he says. Diab is already concerned about the next World Cup.
The signs are troubling. I mean, the next tournament, which is going to be in the United States, Canada and Mexico, you know, spread over a big chunk of a whole hemisphere of the planet. I can't see how that's going to be sustainable or carbon neutral, as they call it.
He says these events have a place in the human family, but that place needs to be a sustainable one. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Now to the globe's other international sporting mega event, the Olympics. Paris will host the games next summer, and Team France is looking to double down on its success in one particular event, judo. It was at the Tokyo Summer Olympics that happened 2 years ago, delayed, as you'll recall, a year because of COVID. France upset host country Japan. After that win, Rebecca Rossman reported this story from a judo training center on the outskirts of Paris.
le dojo, le petit dojo.
Instructor Raymond Demonier shows me the dojo, a rectangular mat that takes up most of the floor space.
Alors je serais incapable de vous dire pourquoi, mais ce sport.
Demonier says, I can't explain why, but France has always excelled at judo, which is good for us, he says. A group of 40 men of all ages pair up and begin the first exercise. Almost all these men are black belts. Their goal, pin their opponent to the ground using precision and power. Or as this man puts it.
So it's sort of like dancing with somebody who's trying to kill you.
That's Sebastian Smith, a journalist based in D.C. who gave up a part of his Paris vacation to train here.
I was here last week, and I'm still aching from then. So everybody here is at a higher level than me.
With nearly 600,000 registered players, or judokas, across the country, judo is one of France's most popular sports. How that happened may be somewhat of a mystery, but a lot of credit is given to French parents who are attracted to the sport's strict moral code that teaches 8 values, including respect, modesty, and self-control.
But you learn to respect your opponent. Before being your opponent, he is your friend.
34-year-old instructor Romain Pousson estimates 80% of French kids have at least dabbled in judo.
For every children, it's a very good sport. I'm the first to advise parents to put their children in judo, but till 10 years old. After, it's better to let them choose what they want to do.
Those that do choose to stick with it have some of the best coaches in the world. Overall, France won 8 judo medals, including 2 golds, and delivered a shocking upset to Japan on its home turf. They were given a hero's welcome when they returned to Paris. The most recognized player, Teddy Riner, took home a gold and a bronze medal, making him the highest medal earner in judo history. Back on the dojo in Paris, there's a young athlete training to beat that record.
Le fait de gagner des compétitions, ça donne envie.
Kayla Issoufi, only 20 years old, says she trains here 8 or 9 times a week in hopes of winning a gold medal on her home turf when Paris hosts the Games in 2024. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
We are all about sports this hour for the love of the game, not to mention politics, money, and culture. Stick around. You're listening to The World. Spanish soccer is grappling with racism among its fans.
You know, generation after generation grows up hearing this being said and then repeats it.
And in China, the main requirement for elite jump rope competitors? Lightning fast feet. The sporting life continues on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It's an all-sports edition of the show today. Now, when it comes to boxing, Cuba punches way above its weight. Cuban boxers have been winning Olympic medals for decades, but in communist Cuba, boxers were not allowed to fight for money, a rule going back to the 1960s. Last year, though, that started to change when Cuba lifted its 60-year ban on professional boxing. The World's TV's Isaiah has our story.
Boxing has been big in Cuba for more than 100 years. It started as a tourist attraction featuring fights with North American boxers, but it got really popular with the locals, and they went on to become world-class champions.
September 18, 1953, Syracuse, New York. Kid Gavilan, the Cuban Hawk, defending the world's welterweight title against Carmen Basilio, the challenger from nearby Canastota, New York, in a scheduled 15-round bout. Round one.
Kid Gavilan was the undisputed world welterweight champion for years. He and other boxers from that period are considered national heroes in Cuba. But not long after the communist revolution, Fidel Castro banned all professional sports in 1961. He said athletes were exploited by big economic powers. Still, Cuban fighters excelled at the Olympics and the amateur system. In fact, in the last 10 years, Cuba has won more Olympic boxing medals than any other country.
Medaille d'or et champion olympique, Cuba!
What an incredible moment for Julio La Cruz, 31 from Cuba, now an Olympic gold medalist.
That's from the Tokyo Olympics in 2020. But Cuban boxers like Julio La Cruz could never hope to earn big bucks in the ring unless they left their country. But now things have changed. On May 20th, Cuba's national boxing team called Los Domadores made history. They took part in a professional competition in Aguascalientes, Mexico.
Pesando 90 kilos con 400 gramos en su debut profesional, el doble campeón olímpico de Camagüey, Cuba, Julio César La Cruz.
La Cruz won that fight with a knockout just a minute and 40 seconds into the second round, and all six members of the Cuban team actually won their fight with five knockouts and a victory by unanimous decision. It's a mix of power, precision, and art that makes Cuba's program the best in the world, according to Alberto Puig de la Barca. He's the president of the Cuban Federation of Boxing.
Pero nos dio la medida de cómo se había ido humanizando el boxeo profesional.
He says professional boxing is more humane nowadays, and the quality of the officiating is better than it used to be, more ethical, he says.
Este es un boxeo con mucho más exigencia.
De la Barca says he wants Cuban boxers to fight at the most competitive level. But another motivation here, he says, is money.
Por peleas que se efectúan, el boxeador gana el 80% de la bonificación de la pelea.
De la Barca says Cuban boxers will get 80% of the prize money for each fight, and the rest will be shared between the coach and the medical staff. But he didn't give any more details. At the event in Mexico, the Cuban team wore matching red shorts instead of gear with brand names from sponsors. But Cuban fighter Julio La Cruz said he was thrilled to be able to fight as a professional for the first time. In an interview with Cuban journalists right after his debut, La Cruz said that was a historic day and that the best of Cuban fighters is yet to come. For the world, I am Tibisay Sea.
Sports showcase people performing at their best. That's what spectators come out to see, excellence. Sadly, in the stands and sometimes on the field of play, we see behavior at its worst, like the racist abuse that fans have hurled at black soccer players, especially in European leagues. This spring, the venom erupted in Spain's La Liga when Real Madrid star player Vinicius Jr. was subjected to racist taunts in Valencia. The abuse escalated throughout the match. Fans chanted monkey at him, prompting Vinicius to respond, and ultimately, he himself was thrown out of the game. Later on social media, Vinicius said that racism is normal in Spanish soccer. Many agreed with him, including Piara Poar, the executive director of the FAIR Network, an anti-discrimination watchdog for global soccer. This all went down at the end of May. Shortly after, we spoke with Poar to get some insight.
So what we've seen here this season in Spain is that Vinicius has been abused now 11 times at different grounds, so it's not the same people who are the perpetrators. And at each of those 11 occasions, the action taken by the authorities, so here that would be the Football Association, the governing body, or the league, has been virtually zero. The league are raising complaints about it, but the regulatory bodies, which is the government and the Football Association, have done nothing effectively. There is the occasional fine of a fan. But the systemic issues that this highlights is the way in which Spanish football is being run and is really disregarding overt racism in the stands. And this is not new for Spain. This is an issue that endures in Spain season after season, year after year. There are times when it's quieter than others, and then suddenly, once every 3 or 4 years, it explodes, as it has this season, with Vinicius as its target.
What have team owners and officials, and particularly the owners of Real Madrid, said?
You know, you generally have a division in Spain
when black players or indeed players of color of other backgrounds are racially abused, you often see their teammates coming together and giving them support. And you see the coach coming out and supporting them. And certainly at Real Madrid, Vinicius Junior's teammates have been very uncompromising in their support of him. His coach, Carlo Ancelotti, came out and gave a very strong statement. But then to counter that, you have the president of La Liga, who is a very influential figure in Spanish sport, probably one of the two most powerful people in sport in Spain. He indulged in what you can only call victim blaming. He referred to Vinicius Junior's behavior and said that he should look at himself as well. Now, some of this, I think, is because Vinicius Junior is blaming the league, but some of it also reflects a wider discourse in Spain and the Spanish media, which is that somehow this young guy, who is 22 years old, he is a footballing phenomenon, probably the best young player in Europe right now, is, as we say here, scoring goals for fun. They are blaming his behavior. You know, they think that he somehow brings it on himself. That's their rationale. How does he do that? He does that by celebrating his goals, by dancing. He does that through sort of a general exuberant behavior. So this is a sort of an analysis that we've seen throughout history, the way in which people of African heritage in particular are seen and the way their behavior is singled out and somehow then used as the reason for the racism that they're suffering.
I mean, it is one among many incidents, though. So I'm wondering what can be done to put an end to this abuse, Piara. Who should be held accountable?
If there is an organization, in the end, you know, the government is responsible for what happens in the country. These are hate crimes that are taking place. And they're also influencing behavior in society. So, you know, it's not uncommon to hear a racist who abuses somebody on the street in Europe and say, well, I saw it on TV. I saw other people doing it to a footballer, so I thought it was acceptable to do that. It seems like an incredibly cheeky, incredibly daring way to defend yourself, but it's been accepted in places as well. But the government should take responsibility. The Football Association in most countries is the ultimate head. And La Liga, which, you know, is a very celebrated league, says that they have no power to act. They can only make complaints. But in fact, it's their league. They could easily address their clubs, easily impose some sanctions of their own, and then put out a wider, more meaningful, more deep, far-reaching campaign to educate people about what's going on and why.
I don't want to blame it on soccer, but I'm wondering, what is it about soccer in Spain, particularly, that you think brings out the worst in people? Is it the crowd? I mean, would these spectators act like this in any other public setting?
Well, one would hope not, because they're not allowed to behave like that in any other public setting. You know, if you do that on the street, the police can be called immediately. If you do that in your workplace, then you're likely to face the sack. The issue is that nobody is telling them that this is not behavior that we want to tolerate, and nobody is showing them the sort of sanctions that will be applied. So it's something that reinforces itself. You know, generation after generation grows up hearing this being said and then repeats it.
Piara, what would you expect this high-profile, headline-making racist abuse in Valencia to do to the overall situation in Spain?
Well, the fact that there's been so much of a public outcry means that this could be a moment of change. But at the same time, you know, we've been here before. And so I think there will be some new things that emerge, some new declarations. But let's see how many others become determined to work together to try to challenge what's going on. Because I think it's the follow-up to the words that we've been missing for a very long time.
Piara Pouar is the executive director of the FAIR Network, an anti-discrimination network for global soccer. Thank you very much for your time, Piara.
Thank you very much.
In Sonora, Mexico, there's a small but growing group of extreme athletes who are pushing themselves to newer extremes, surrounded by stunning natural beauty. Hopefully that landscape isn't too distracting, because these athletes are highliners. They walk a flat tightrope strung between high, steep cliffs. Reporter Murphy Woodhouse reports on the daredevils of Sonora, Mexico.
It's mid-morning and warming up in a backyard citrus grove in remote Guasavas, Mexico. The town sits in a river valley flanked by soaring, dry sierras. Using the dirt as a whiteboard, a sizable, motley crew of adventurers, mostly Sonorans, a Belgian, even a ferret named Toto, puts the day's plan together. Their task deserves careful deliberation. It's about safely stringing tightropes across the chasms of Sonora's famed Cruz del Diablo, or Devil's Cross Canyon. These sheer stone walls rise hundreds of feet. To begin spanning one gap that day, they'll use a bow and arrow. Sitting in her tent, 22-year-old University of Sonora biology student Argelia Gil Samaniego is getting ready.
Le he estado dando al highline desde hace dos años.
She's been practicing highline for a few years. It's a discipline of the balancing sport called slacklining that features lines strung dozens or even hundreds of feet in the air. This will be Samaniego's most ambitious effort yet.
Voy con expectativas, pero sin expectativas.
She says she's fine with whatever she can achieve. What she knows for certain is that she's feeling strong and calm. Plan set, the group makes its way up the winding mountain road to the canyon. This will be the second and last full day of preparation for a long weekend of walking the lines. At a popular overlook some 2,000 feet above the valley floor, the group unloads harnesses, packs, food and water, and gears up for the hard work ahead. Abraham Puigfarat is the archer. He wraps a thin fishing line around a short length of pipe, like a fishing reel, so that the arrow draws the line cleanly as it flies through the air. Puigfarat is new to highline. Accompanying him to his perch is the much more experienced Osmar González, known as Pajarito, or Little Bird. Pajarito says he calls the Devil's Cross Sonora's Highline University. Breath stilled and anchored to a tree, Puigfarat pulls the arrow back and raises the bow. Success. With the thin line across, a thicker one follows, and then, with three teams split up around the canyon, a slow, carefully choreographed effort to move their gear over the abyss.
¿Puedes recuperar?
A moment's carelessness could undo hours of tedious work. With shouts, whistles, and phone calls, they coordinate.
Tranqui.
Knots in the line and other complications frustrate, but the team works together to keep stress in check. Several hours after the arrow, they send the actual line they'll be walking across. It's flat webbing, an inch wide, with another dangling below, in case the main line fails.
Una, dos, tres. Una, dos, tres.
They pull the line taut as the daylight starts to fade. In all, they set up three lines over the canyon.
About thing. Gonna be all right.
With the Bob Marley anthem echoing between the walls and headlamps and a near full moon now the only light, Pajarito, the last of the north side team, pulls himself across the yawning blackness.
Creo que al ser tan grande nuestro estado y ser tan joven el deporte.
Back at camp the next morning, Pajarito says that the combination of vast, geographically diverse Sonora and such a young sport means that highlining has a lot of potential.
Te retan demasiado.
The Devil's Cross figures prominently in Sonora's highline world, he says. But its height and shifting winds are a serious challenge. It brings up questions, he says, like, is this really what I want to be doing? Luis Flores loses his balance and plummets before his safety rope catches him. Dangling hundreds of feet above the canyon floor, he gathers himself and climbs back up onto the line. To keep his focus, he sings to himself.
Paso, 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 paso.
And chance, and soon is back on firm ground. The shock is still with him after several minutes of cooling down, along with euphoria. Being close to death, Flores says, makes you feel alive. On a nearby line, Gil Samaniego, the biology student, is finding her balance.
Okay, Argelia.
Her friends help her back to the canyon's edge.
Del uno al diez, seis.
From 1 to 10, she put her fear at 6.
Pues las vistas, El equilibrio, la paz mental que
more powerful than the fear, though, were the views, the peace and equilibrium, she says.
Es tuyo el mundo ahí.
And the feeling that the whole world was hers. For The World, Murphy Woodhouse, in Sonora, Mexico.
Murphy is a reporter with the Mountain West News Bureau. Flip through TV channels in China, and there's a good chance you'll find shows featuring jump rope competitions.
Judges ready. Jumpers ready. Set.
We're not just talking double dutch here. These jump ropers are bouncing at speeds you cannot imagine. Chinese viewers aren't only watching to be entertained. The World's Rebecca Canther brought us this story from Shanghai.
Before Yolanda Cheng's daughter started first grade, her new school sent out a notice. Students must be able to jump rope more than 100 times in a minute.
So at the beginning, I feel it's just you force me to jump. I don't like it. If you don't do it, your score in the primary school will be like no pass. She has to do that.
Her daughter is athletic. Cheng has signed her up for ballet, swimming, traditional Chinese dance, tennis, and soccer. But she could only jump rope 10 times in a row.
My daughter at that time was very poor at rope jumping, so I pay attention to that.
So they got to work. Cheng had her daughter jump rope for a minute every morning before breakfast.
Jump up.
Like many other parents around China, she took a video and uploaded it to an app called Jump Rope Every Day. A little girl in central Henan province currently holds the records for most skips per minute, 278. In her video, she wears a determined look on her face as she jump ropes on a yoga mat in her family's living room. You can barely see the rope as it flies through the air. Most kids aren't that fast. After school and on the weekends in parks around China, you'll see kids jumping rope under the watchful eye of parents or grandparents. In China, where classrooms can have upwards of 40 students, jump rope is a relatively inexpensive sport, and it doesn't take up much space either. So it's become a popular measure of students' fitness. And it's not just a requirement. It impacts your final grade. But not everyone is a natural. So some parents sign their kids up for jump rope cram classes. At this after-school jump rope center, teachers take students through stretches and exercises and then coach them on the finer points of skipping rope. My neighbor, Lillian Zhang, sent her son. We didn't pay attention to jump rope before, so he could only jump 3 or 4 times, she says. His coordination isn't so good, but I didn't want it to affect his confidence level. Huang Haimin works at the jump rope center. Parents bring their kids to the center because they want them to have an edge, she says. The jump roping requirement might sound silly, but Lenora Chu says it highlights how China's education system sorts people into categories. She's an education expert.
It's basically like climbing a ladder with a test at every rung of the ladder. So they will prioritize what is on those tests. Now, if the Beijing government comes down to say, we now think that physical education and health is important, and here's how we're going to measure it, then parents in turn will then value what they're told to prioritize. And as long as those testing mechanisms are there, and they're so critical and important, then anything that they do is not going to take away that pressure.
But parent Yolanda Cheng is encouraged by the stronger emphasis on physical education.
And I always think in the future, the competition is not just like your IQ, your academic performance. It's really how energetic you will be, you know.
She says for all her annoyance at being forced to send videos of her kids skipping rope every day, it worked. After cramming jump rope with her daughter, she saw an improvement.
You know, she can jump 120, even higher, for only 1 minute. And then she can jump only with 1 foot. And she was very happy at that.
And Cheng says recently she actually went out and bought a jump rope for herself. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Every athlete will tell you how you eat is a critical part of training, especially at elite levels. The dining halls at the Olympic Games provide a great illustration of the global variations of good nutrition. The World's Bianca Hillier reported this story during the 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics.
It's not hard to imagine why feeding 3,000 athletes from 90 countries is tricky. But Fiona Pelly has had a lot of practice. She's a dietitian in Queensland, Australia, and has evaluated Olympic menus for more than 20 years.
The way we break it down is by food being provided for types of cultures and diets.
Everything from vegan and gluten-free dishes to Chinese food and grilled entrees. Plus,
there's always something to meet religious needs like halal. So if you break it down into those sort of groupings, it makes it a little bit easier.
The Beijing Olympics dining hall planned 200 dishes per day. 30% was food from across Asia, and the rest was Western and international cuisine. That's according to COU, the project manager of the dining services at the Olympic Village.
就是在挑选这些菜品的时候，我们是在一个非常非常。
She says winnowing down the choices is difficult, and the most important consideration is how well the food gets athletes across the finish line.
这些运动员是来比赛的。
She points out athletes are in Beijing to participate in a competition, not to travel and taste all kinds of local cuisines as tourists. She says if you were to see the menu, it may look a bit monotonous or simple. Pelly says the Olympic dining hall is just like any old cafeteria. It's a fishbowl.
For example, it might be that you look at somebody else who's got a reputation as, you know, being number one or whatever in your particular sport. You might go, oh, so-and-so is eating that. Maybe that's what I should be eating.
In other words, I'll have what they're having. Pelly says knowing what to eat can be a challenge for some athletes, so there's a nutrition desk inside the dining hall for everyone to use.
We've had coaches come up with their entire team when it's a smaller team, you know, smaller country, and want education around sports nutrition basics, and is really rewarding because it's a legacy that they can take back.
But athletes from bigger and better funded teams have even more resources.
The dining hall is my office.
Angela Dufour is the lead performance dietitian with the Canadian Olympic Committee.
I have a lot of athletes maybe messaging me, I'm gluten-free. There's no gluten-free options here. Can you come see it? Or I'm sick. It was the food. Got to check it out, which normally isn't the food. It's just nerves or whatever.
Dufour also helps stock the team lounge, where Canadians can quickly grab stuff like cereal or coffee. She says athletes are usually pretty strict with their nutrition prescription, as she called it, but it's not all about choosing the most protein-packed meal. Pelly says the dining hall takes special requests on occasion.
If you have a birthday while you're there, you can actually request a birthday cake.
And for Team Canada, Dufour says a national comfort food will do.
Maple syrup, obviously.
Nothing like some pancakes to celebrate a gold medal. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Ending this hour with a good meal, and that's going to do it for today's Global Sports Edition of The World. We come to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.